time for Message in the Bottle. Brought to you by Bangor Wine and Cheese Company at 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor. Eric Meehan is with us in studio. Good afternoon, sir.
Hi there. How's everybody doing out there in Radio Land? Retro Radio Land.
Retro Radio Land. I'm very retro. I'm feeling retro today.
Well, it was funny listening to your interview earlier with Herman Peter. You've got to think like Pink Floyd that someone's like, all right, so who's Herman? You? Peter? No? You. Now you're Herman.
You're Herman.
I don't
now.
Care what your name is. You're the bassist. You're Herman. We need a Herman. It's like the Gary Clark Five.
Yeah.
There had to be a Gary Clark. Yep. Otherwise, you're just five people.
You're Alice Cooper.
You're Alice Cooper. Vince.
Yeah.
I think that was actually the first sort of stage name that I ever learned about because of the Wayne's World backstage pass scene. And like, wait a minute, who's this guy? And learning like, oh, and I don't know why that rocked my world so much, but it was interesting to think that like people would adopt stage names. And, you know, because I would never come up with a good stage name.
I love the Alice Cooper story, too, that when he went solo,
yeah,
he reached out to the guys in the band and said, look, this name has value because of you guys. So I'm cutting you in on royalties as long as I'm a solo artist, and still does.
He's a right guy.
Yeah.
And all of his, for those of you who know or don't know, I play guitar in a band and I'm a rock lover. He has a history of just amazing, amazing musicians playing for him, including right up till now. He has one of, you know, the hotshot young guitarist, Nita Strauss, who's, you know, getting all the endorsements on, and she plays for Alice Cooper. It's, you know, she's not chasing, you know, big gigs. She's got some of the greatest tunes of all time to play. So very cool stuff.
Yeah.
Well, we're here to talk about wine. It's February now, which is good and bad, as you noted. It is the time of year that we get slaughtered weather-wise, and that we're in for that. That should be fun. It's also the time of year that we're starting to talk about wine agriculture and purity in the bottle this month. And so it's a fun time to sort of talk about the kind of wines that you're going to find, frankly, on my shelf, the good wines, the wines that are being made by people who still remember that, you know, what ultimately ends up in the bottle is a form of agriculture. It's a living, breathing sort of thing, which is one of the reasons I love wine so much. Vintage matters, where it's grown matters, who dealt with it matters. So today I figured we'd talk about the life cycle of wine, right? Because people really don't appreciate the agriculture side of it. The fact that before there's ever bottled alcohol, there's grapes, and before there's grapes, there's vines, and before there's vines, there's soil, and you've got to choose where to put the vines and stuff like that. So I thought I'd talk about a little bit about that. So obviously, before there are even vines in the ground, you've got to choose optimum territory to grow your wine, your vines rather. And so I want to remind everybody that you really want a place that's not ultra fertile, not ultra, you know, places where you would grow, you know, the amber waves of grain sort of things. Amber waves of grain means super nice, fertile, flat earth. You do not want that. You want places where there's slopes, where there's good drainage, where there's, you know, usually very good wind to prevent, you know, mildew and things like that. So very often hillsides. And then here in the northern hemisphere, very often you're talking about south and southwesterly facing hillsides. Those are considered optimal to get the maximum sun exposure and dryness and things like that, while still putting your vines on soils that are, you know, higher up, have to struggle a little bit, have to sink the roots really deep and strain. And then also, of course, as when you plant, there's other ways that you can add to that, but you're looking for soils. And there's, of course, you know, there's companies out there that specialize in doing these sort of soil tests for oenological purposes, and you can spend a lot or a little, but essentially, you know, of course, there's the tales of the old masters who could just kind of walk onto a hillside and pick up the dirt and know. And I'm sure that there's still people who, you know, they get feel. I mean, I was with a winemaker in France in the area called Saint-Poussin, and he drove us around and he pointed at this hillside and he said, "Do you see that?" And I said, "Yeah." He's like, that's the next Côte d'Or, which refers to one of Burgundy's most famed and expensive white wine slopes. He's like, it's exactly the same orientation, exactly the same latitude, and it's just shifted over slightly. behind this mountain range. And if you can see, it used to be vine lands, you know, back when people, it was actually a very, very famous and wealthy area at one point. But right now it's just overgrown. And so, you know, some people can really sort of tell. So you got to find where to plant your vines. And then, of course, you got to choose what to plant. And of course, there's a lot of things that'll tell you what to plant. And there's a lot of different nurseries that specialize in vines in many, many countries. So you don't have to go to, you know, California to UC Davis. You can go to France. You can go to Australia. You can go to South Africa. Lots of different places where there are people developing vines in nurseries, different clones, different ones that you can pick for your soil. And then you put them in. And for the first couple of years, you do not expect to yield anything from these. And of course, you will get some grape clusters here and there, but you're not going to get any real good concentrated wine. Why? Because the roots haven't plunged themselves very deep. It's not really a producing plant at this point. When it's very young, you're going to cover it up even with it kind of looks like, you know, very thick paper to keep the vine insulated. And then when it grows, I mean, you're going to train it. And that means, you know, putting up the guide wires and, you know, tying the vines onto these wires. And so, you know, it kind of looks like a vineyard. And then, of course, right about now, while the vines are still kind of dormant, of course, they're still getting nutrients from deep down in the soil. But right now you're going around, you're pruning. There's no fruit. There's no leaves. There's no anything. It's cold. I mean, the vines know it, too. So they kind of shut down a little bit. And this is the time when you go out and you sort of pick how you're going to prune it so that when March, April, May starts to roll around, you're going to start to see, you know, activity. You're going to see vitality. And how you've pruned it is going to sort of define your ultimate yields and things like that. If you leave a lot of chances for vines to grow, it's going to spend a lot of its energy growing that vine. It's not going to put a lot of energy into growing fruit on the couple of vines that you may have allowed it. And so in March, primarily, you know, in you know, Napa and places where there's actual, you know, heat, you're going to start to see what we call bud break in March. And this is still a dangerous time because frosts are still very possible. And so vineyard managers have to really go out and, you know, make sure if there's weather forecast that they are either using these huge industrial fans to circulate air or, fascinating enough, they'll even spray a little bit of water on the vines because when the act of freezing actually generates a little bit of heat, so it's better to have just a little bit of ice on your vine as opposed to just instant frost and wind. And then, so, you know, the vine will continue to go and eventually you'll see these little tendrils come out. Little tiny grapes, and leaves are going to start to come out. And so the next choice you have is canopy management because, of course, you want the leaves to absorb and do the photosynthesis thing, and you want them to shelter the grapes a little bit from the sun's heat, but not a lot. So you got to trim and do this and that and figure out just how many leaves you want on your vines. And then they're going to start to have flowers, and these little grape things are going to become a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger, but they're also going to be really sort of this intense young green until the time that we call veraison, French term, basically comes from the Latin, like veritas. It's kind of the truth, when the truth comes, right? These green little baby things turn into full-fledged grapes, and if they're red grapes, guess what? They turn red. If they're white grapes, they turn a milder shade of green, a lighter shade of green. And that's when you're starting to, like, get, you know, the beautiful, beautiful. I mean, that's when there's just a million colors in the vineyards. And then you're just timing for ripeness. How ripe do you want it? So if you're, say, a champagne producer, you're going to be harvesting fairly early because what you're really looking for is kind of that greenness, very high acidity, not a lot of sugar, because eventually you're going to be blending all those very green wines into something that you're going to put through secondary fermentation, and it's going to go through all the processes that we've talked about when we talk about how to make sparkling wines. So you ultimately start with a very, you know, very acidic, tart grape. For other white wines, like your Sauvignon Blancs and other things that are not super acidic but very crispy, September, you know, you're looking at that. Maybe even earlier, as we've talked about on this show, harvests are getting earlier and earlier because of global warming, believe it or not, but it's a thing. So you'll see that. And then, of course, for your riper grapes, your Cabs, your Zinfandels, your Syrahs, you're going into October, you're harvesting very often very early in the morning. I'm talking like 3 a.m. early in the morning. So you retain the acids because the acids are going to come out in the cooler evening. So you retain the acids, you get them in, and there's no, you know, oxidization when the sun comes out. You get them into the winery, and then you crush. And that's essentially when you've taken that grape, you know, off the market. You've introduced oxygen. You've introduced whatever yeast you're going to use or wild yeast to ferment. And that's the beginning of your wine, your beautiful, you know, fermented alcoholic beverage. But it takes a long, long time. I mean, years to get to even producing grapes that are worth harvesting. And then, of course, very, very serious vineyard management before you ever get there. Of course, there, and we'll talk, you know, in the next couple of weeks about organic and biodynamic and spraying this and spraying that. But essentially, what we just talked about is the time when you're going to be doing all that organic practices. Where is that, you know, what's in that soil? What are you spraying on those grapes? What are you doing in that vineyard to either encourage natural growth or kill everything in sight or somewhere in between? And very often it's somewhere in between. I mean, we'll talk about that as well. But for now, let's enjoy the wine I brought today. So this is a biodynamically farmed. So this is very, you know, all organic, no chemical pesticides, blah, 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 blah. So this is from Piedmont, Italy, right? So the northwestern corner where they do Barolos, Barbarescos, things like this. This is from a Barolo producer. This is the Nebbiolo grape. They're Langhe Nebbiolo, so Langhe is sort of the larger region there. 2016 from Guido Bono. And I just kind of thought it was kind of fun. We're getting into a nice wine night here. And this has a lot of elements, not only of fruit, but of like damp forest floor, kind of interesting things like that.
This is worth the work that you just described, I will say. I want to thank them
for there you go.
Putting in that time.
And that's the point. You get real wines that smell like interesting things by choosing the right soils and choosing the right terroir and all that sort of stuff. And I did want to mention our tasting this month is on the 15th. So it is the third Thursday, but it is kind of early because our first day was Thursday, the first. So the 15th from 5 to 7, we'll be having some excellent, excellent wines. That's all I have to say about that. What do you have to say about that?
I'm reading about Lamb Chopper.
Oh, Lamb Chopper, yes, our excellent cheese of the week, our specialty feature for the next 2 weeks from Cypress Grove. So this is their very nice, mild, kid-friendly, I shouldn't say kid when we're talking about goats and sheep, child-friendly, mild sheep's cheese. Very, very good for those who are lactose intolerant or slightly tolerant because of the fat molecule size. I won't get into it right now, but essentially, like goat milk, sheep milk is very, very good for you as opposed to cow milk if that's a problem for you. So come check that out. And our wine of the week is also a nice Tuscan red from imported by a friend of mine. So check that out. And we'll see you here next Tuesday.
Rick Meehan, Bangor Wine and Cheese Company. Message in the bottle every Tuesday. Visit them at 86 Hammond Street in downtown Bangor.